Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out the podcast. I'm very excited about this guest. This is somebody that I've made out to, gotten very drunk to, sped and broke speed limits to. Peter Frampton, rock legend, one of the biggest selling albums of all time, Frampton Comes Alive, one of the greatest guitarists in rock. We talk about a lot of stuff, how fame helped him, how it hurt him, David Bowie. Really cool interview, wide-ranging. Hope you enjoy it. Peter Frampton. You're in Nashville, right? That's where you're based out of now?
Yes, it's my home now. I came here in the 90s and lived here for about four or five years and then had to, family reasons, had to move out of town for a while. But no, I moved back and enjoying it. I mean, it's definitely the place. I've got a wonderful place to live and a wonderful little studio. So what could be more for a music? What could a musician want more than that?
That's absolutely right. Well, it's great to have you on the show. For those listening, I'm talking to one of the greatest guitarists in the history of rock, and his 1976 album, Frampton Comes Alive, which I did so much air guitar too as a kid, is one of the top-selling live records of all time. He's won a Grammy Award and has been inducted into the Musicians Hall of Fame, and it's Peter Frampton, and it's so great to have you on. I've been such a big fan, and my wife has been such a big fan, so we were very excited that we had an opportunity to talk to you about your book, which is your memoir, Do You Feel Like I Do? Great to have you on.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on, Paul.
Let me say a couple of things. First of all, you've made me the greatest air guitarist in the history of the planet because I just would totally shred your songs like a geek. And secondly, I would make out to my wife a lot to your music in our car. We went to high school together, so I thank you for that.
Okay, that's a little bit too much information there, Paul, for me, but carry on.
Well, she's the reason we're talking. She saw that you had a book out. She's like, oh my God, you have to talk to Peter Frampton, and she's in love with you. And then fell more in love with you when we were doing our research and found out that you love black raspberry ice cream with chocolate chips. And she's a huge black raspberry ice cream fan with chocolate sprinkles. So we have a lot in common.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Graters is the one. Oh, my goodness. Oh, we shouldn't advertise. Sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay. All good.
So Graters from Cincy.
Yeah, that that's what I read. Yeah, we got, when I go to Cincy to perform, I got to check it out. You were on the Colbert Report in 2006. I worked on that show. I worked on the Daily Show and I was working on the Colbert Report at the time, and you came on and did that great bit about Father Christmas and the Guitar Hero, and everybody was so excited on the show that you were there. It was really cool.
Oh, it was wonderful, and I actually got him to use the talk box as well at the end of the show. I have this great picture of me laughing behind him as he's got the talk box in his mouth.
Yeah, it was great. He almost choked to death. We were all on the floor. It was like... and Steve is the kind of guy who's game for anything. So the minute you put a challenge up to him, he's going for it 100%, you know?
Right. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
So your book is really great. It's a great window into your life, but also there are a lot of great life lessons for people, whether you're in the arts or not. And one of the things you seem to hit on a fair amount is being tested, failure, resiliency. And one of the quotes that came out of the book was, you said, I think learning from my mistakes was the biggest lesson. Like, my career was front loaded. So much happened to me between the time I was 14 and 19. What have been some of the bigger hurdles that you had to overcome? And was there one in particular or a couple where you thought, I can't overcome this, but you did?
It's all the same thing, really. But it is coupled with the fact that after the live album was so huge, being the biggest selling album of all time to that point, that year, that created a problem. Being number one in the charts is one thing, but being the biggest of anything ever is scary, because now there's only one of you. And I was already getting flack from, because of my looks, after people finally saw what I looked like after they bought the album. A lot of people didn't know they just bought the album because they liked it. And then there were all these pictures out there with my shirt off. And, you know, I played into the hands of those people that could make more money if I took my shirt off on the front cover of a magazine. That's basically what I did. And I learned definitely from that mistake, because what it did was it was to push the guys to the back of the hall and the girls to the front. And that's a pop star's career, that teeny bopper kind of stardom. That's about an 18-month career till they grow out of you. And whereas a musician's career is a lifetime. So I think after Comes Alive was put out and became so enormous, it was the follow-up album, Even There I Was Again, with all the hair done and everything. And so it was me that I take responsibility for that, but it definitely, I'm In You was nowhere near, that was the follow-up to Comes Alive, had nowhere near the good material that Frampton Comes Alive on. And I knew it wouldn't have before I even started it, because it took me 6 years to write the material for Frampton Comes Alive. Mm-hmm. And now it looked like I had a maximum of 6 months before the pressure was building from management and the team. You better do it. The old rules were you go out and you do it again straight away. Well, when you're the biggest selling record of all time, there's probably no need to rush out and do another one right away. Mm. And the Eagles have proven this over and over again. You think they've had 70 albums out, but it's probably about 7 studio albums, because they never go, they're still going, thank goodness. They never go to the studio until they've got enough material. So I just didn't have enough material.
Because you hadn't lived enough of a life yet in 6 months, right? I mean, one of the things of what makes great artists and great art is that you're tapping into your life, right? That's why you had such a wealth to tap into of 6 years of living to write that album and why it was so good. But when you've got 6 months, you've got nothing to go to. Is that right?
And also feeling scared that I had lost, because the other thing was, this was a live album that was so successful, and it's not going to, a studio album is, even if I do the Bruce Springsteen routine and try and make it sound as live as possible, still not a live record. People want to hear more of that from me, obviously. So that was perturbing, to say the least, right, as well, because in my own mind, I loved the Frampton record. I thought that was my best solo record until Comes Alive came out. Studio record. I had not, in my own mind, proven myself had a huge hit as a studio record. This was a live one.
And you were scared that you had to top what you just did, which was an insanely successful record. And at a young age, by the way, I just want to remind everybody, how old are you? At the 24, 25, at the mid-20s at the time?
I was 25 when I recorded it, and actually 25 when it came out, and 26 was in April. So it was almost, I think it went to number one for my birthday.
Wow. There you go. and this is why, when I said early on that this book is really a great tutorial, because you say, talk about stay who you are. You know, you talk about the pressure from management, and you say, you know, that managers can advise you on how to make it better, maybe. And I would listen to that, try. And if it doesn't work for you, it doesn't work, but always listen to your gut.
Yes.
And you had to learn that the hard way, right?
Yes, because when you've got the biggest of anything, or a huge record like that, and you're around, you're being, your team are people that have handled lots of other artists, you initially think, well, they obviously know best because I've not been in this position before. But then again, neither had they been in this position before.
So yeah. Mm-hmm.
instead of biding our time and not dousing the success of Comes Alive by releasing something else, we could have just let it go. And you know, I needed, in hindsight, it's very easy to say, you know, I should have, every songwriter in the world and producer would have wanted to work with me at that point. So I should have got out of my own way at that point. And I still thought I could do it all on my own, and written some wonderful songs with some terrific writers, got on board a phenomenal producer that I really could work well with. But that didn't happen. There was no time for all that.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, look, I understand, you know, I have a manager myself and an agent, and there's like two forms of representation. They'll either sit around and wait till you generate something and then jump on board and, you know, get the easy money when it's easy to sell you, or, you know, you become big and then it's about their motivations are money first. And for the most part, I don't want to generalize and say every manager and agent's like this, but, and then on top of it, you're a young kid. You're still a child in a lot of ways in your early 20s. And it's like, wow, like you see it. I mean, you were cheated out of money, right? I mean, a lot of money. And how did that happen? I know you talk about it in the book.
I never got into music because of money, and but I was always very lucky to have enough to get by and pay the rent or the mortgage, you know. Then, of course, Comes Alive comes in, and I was almost embarrassed as to how much money this was generating, and thrilled, you know, obviously. But I let people handle it, you know, because I was.
Yeah.
It was too much for me.
Absolutely. That's totally understandable, yeah.
And I thought they knew what they would do. Well, there was all sorts of stuff going on behind my back that I didn't know about. And certain deals that were told to me a certain way were not that way when I signed them. Stuff like that. And yeah. But basically, you know, when it came to asking... In 1977, 8, where's my publishing money from my manager? He said, well, I've spent it. So that's about the size of it, you know?
Wow. Oh, God.
And there's plenty more of that, I could be a bitter old man, but I'm not.
Yeah.
Because also, not only did he alleviate me of a lot of money, but, you know, he was the reason, D'Anthony, was the reason Humble Pie was successful. He went to bat for them, and he went to bat for me, you know. And he definitely guided my career in a way in how to make it. When you are a performing act, and that's to play in front of as many people as you can in the shortest space of time and grab the headliner's audience. And that's what we did with Humble Pie, and that's what I did with my solo career. And even down to when we had the de-settlement, well, that's funny, D'Anthony, de-settlement. But I mean, the settlement, but it was a de-settlement. You know, I just couldn't wait to sign and get out of there, you know, because I was getting my publishing back and my life back, basically. And he just turned around, and my career wasn't, it was in the 80s at that point. And my career was, you know, just below the first rung on the ladder again. Oh. And he just looked at me and he said, you'll be fine. You know what to do. And I knew exactly what he meant. You know, just go out and play there. And I didn't feel like playing. I'd been playing for 10 years, 11 years, 12 years straight, nonstop from The Herd, Humble Pie, Frampton, and I'm supposed to be able to take a break now. But of course, the income stream is starting to fail. Yeah. And what that's failing. Plus, he took a lot of money from me, so it was a difficult situation for quite a few years.
And what were you doing at that time? Did you just step away completely from performing and writing, or how did you generate some income, or were you able to just live a meager existence for a while?
Well, before things got really bad, before the tsunami, no, I was living in New York with my wife, Barbara, at the time, and it really wasn't a great time. But we had the most wonderful thing happen. We had a baby daughter, Jade. So that's when I became a father. So it was almost perfect timing that I was taking time off from the road to be a dad, you know, did that. And that was very fulfilling. And then I slowly started getting back into it bit by bit, but it wasn't until I think 85 when I was doing the Premonition record, first record for Ahmet at Atlantic, Ahmet Erdogan, my dear friend, and Ahmet, yeah, Peter, get over here, hey. So
he sounds like one of those mafia guys that you were introduced to.
Yeah, you know, he did.
I'm Italian. I know those guys, and I got one of them in my family, so I know those guys. Yeah.
Well, I've been around a lot, so. but. No, so, you know, so I got an album. But then, you know, things got so bad that I had to, and in the book I say this, is that Ahmet was a dear friend. He really was. I miss him dearly. And I was already signed with Atlantic, and they'd already given me an advance, but I owed so much money from mistakes that had been made since D'Anthony by other business management people who'd left liens for, oh gosh, it was a mess. Mm. You know, I was a mess. And so I had to go, in order to continue living, I had to go and ask for a loan from Ahmet Erdogan. And he said, how much you need? And I said, whatever, you'll read in the book how much it was. And he said, there'll be a check waiting for you as you leave. And I've never ever asked anybody other than Ahmet for a loan in my life. Except for mortgages, obviously, but I mean a personal loan like that. And never forgot that. Ahmet was a wonderful man.
That's great. Well, if you weren't a wonderful guy, he wouldn't have done it. So I'm sure it's a big reflection on who you are. And, you know, there's two central figures that come out. There are a lot of key, Ahmet being one of them, but there's several key figures in your life. And two that stood out to me are your parents, I'll make them one, and David Bowie. And I was there to say, in reading about your relationship with your parents and the start of your musical career, that if it weren't for World War II, you might not have been a musician, right? Because as I understand it, your mom wanted to be an actress, but her mother wouldn't let her. Her mother wanted her to be a secretary and bring money home. And your mother remembered that. And coming out of and surviving the Blitz, they didn't want to continue, or she, to live what's called the Victorian life prior to the war. And they wanted, and your mother in particular, wanted you to be happy and do something that would make you happy, which a lot of parents did at the time. And I didn't realize, you point out, that that's why England produced a lot of great art and musicians after the war, because parents wanted their kids to enjoy life, given how close it came to losing their lives. Talk about
exactly.
Your mom. Talk about your mom a little bit. I know your dad was a teacher at a tech school, an art teacher where you went, but I think it's just such a great story on how that came about.
Yes. Well, my mother, first of all, at high school, was in a school play, and one of the great dame actresses. You get the name Dame put in front of your name when you're that good and that treasured in England. And the best actress at the time, most respected, offered her a scholarship to RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, which is the bee's knees where everybody as an actress wants to go. You know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, she said, I'm giving you a scholarship. I see that you've got it. And she said, all you need is £50, which might as well have been £10,000 at that point. Everything else will be free. Your tuition will be free, for everything, you know. And so she couldn't wait to rush home to her mother. And we're talking about late, early 30s, 1930s, late 20s, early 30s, obviously. And that's when my, maybe mid 30s. And my mother said, yes, she gave me a scholarship. All I need is £50. And her mother, my grandmother, just turned around to her and said, you're not going to be an actress. You're going to be a secretary and get a nice job and bring money home. And so her, can you imagine that?
No, it's, yeah, it's just.
Everything, her whole life was doused in front of her, you know. Mm. That was the kibosh, was put on the acting. Mm. So I believe, but then she became a very good secretary and then worked under Selfridge's during the war for an American general and knew when D-Day was before my father did. So she was in all those special meetings, you know, with presidents and Churchill and all that. So isn't that wild?
It's what a full life for such a young person. I mean, she couldn't have been that, you know, what, 20s, 30s at that point. That's amazing.
Yeah,
that
in her early 20s. Yeah, yeah.
Did she not feel, was it because of the time, you know, you just did what your parents said, plus she's a woman and they tended not to have the authority that men did, unfortunately. Was she just didn't feel like she could push back on her mom and say, no, I'm going to go do this?
Yeah, it was the last vestiges of a Victorian.
Yeah.
Kind of a Cinderella syndrome with my mother, unfortunately. Mm. So it was very hard on her. And so when she saw me pick up that banjolele when I was 7 years old, and within half a day I'd learned three songs taught to me by my dad, she and Dad looked at each other and went, oh dear.
we've created a monster. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, they had. So so throughout my parented career, meaning living with my parents, everything had to go through them, obviously, because I was still at school. Whenever I needed to get clearance for a certain Sunday night's performance. Oh, it's only a special one night Sunday, Mum. Really? Tell Dad that. So it was every Sunday.
Yeah, but we all have that. We all have the good cop, bad cop parents, and you always go to right. You go to the good cop to try to help you out with the bad cop, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's. I'm not looking at Dad, but I know there's steam coming out of his ears. You know. So, but it was. It was her that talked him into it every time. So joining the Herb was the big one because I was 16. I wanted to go back to school to the sixth form and then take my A-levels and go to music college, the Guildhall School of Music. I had the prospectus and everything. And that I wanted to be an arranger, you know, so.
What I couldn't figure out in reading the book and doing some of the research is your dad is an art teacher. So he's in the arts. Mm-hmm. He just said he even taught you some songs. Why was he the one that was a little bit of an obstacle for you going into this as a career? I would think, you know, usually someone in the arts himself gets it, or was it that, you know, he viewed it as a hard life for you and he wanted your life to not be so hard maybe?
No, I don't think that. I just think, you know, various bands were asking me to go professional from when I was like 10 years old. And one day, one of the fathers of one of the other players said to my dad, Well, let him go professional now. You can always buy your education later. That's the wrong thing to say to a teacher who happens to be my father. If that gives you insight into where he was coming from.
Yeah.
He wanted me to have a full schooling. The last thing he wanted me to do was to drop out and not, he wanted me to go to college. So did I, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was the plan, you know. Yeah. So when things circumvented that with the herd asking me in 1966 to play with them for the summer and then asked me to join the band, that wasn't on the cards at all. So Mum had to, I think Mum locked him in the closet and she said, yeah, it's okay.
He came out, where's Peter? He just went to get some milk. He'll be back in 6 months. Yeah.
He just went to join the herd. Oh, mean man.
What happened when you were seven and you picked up that instrument? Like, was there, do you remember a feeling? And then how the heck did you learn three songs in half a day? Do you just know even at seven? Like, do you remember what feelings that evoked in you?
I just knew that it was something that I really enjoyed, and I'm picking this up pretty quickly. It's coming to me pretty easily, especially on a banjolele, which is a ukulele banjo shaped with these four gut strings. And the thing was, you know, Nana and Granddad would come round, and my father's parents would come round for tea on Sunday or whatever, and cucumber sandwiches, of course. Mum would say, "Oh, Peter, play. She's coming round the mountain when she comes," or play Tom Dooley. So I was the party piece.
So I see.
And I started performing in the living room, to my relatives. And that's where I got the bug, because I saw, wow, I can see the look on their faces of enjoyment, you know? And that's when I first got the bug of performing, you know?
Yeah, I know the feeling.
It was just so exciting to see you could do something that would make somebody else enjoy it.
Yes.
You could see their enjoyment. It was palpable, you know?
Exactly.
I got that very early.
Yeah, I had before going into entertainment and being a comedian, I was a lawyer and investment banker on Wall Street, and I started writing for jokes for Jay Leno, and then he encouraged me to go to bars and try them out, and I got that first laugh and that 5 minutes of material, and it's exactly the same feeling, and you can't really explain it to somebody who's not a performer, but it's just like, it meant more to me and hit me in a place that making all that money on Wall Street didn't. You know, it just grabbed me by the throat and was like, oh my God, like what a great feeling. And that you're giving something to people that they need, you know, in their life. And do you have a second to talk about David Bowie and how he, you've said, I could never thank David Bowie enough for going with your gut, as you say, and helping you. And if you'd have a second to talk about that, that'd be great.
Well, David, you know, obviously I met him at school. Before I went to the school, I saw him play with this band, the Conrads, at the school on a weekend charity thing. And I was mesmerized by watching him, and which was, he must have been very mesmerizing because the guitar player in the band, Neville, had a white Fender Stratocaster. I'd never seen one before. And I was salivating over, but I couldn't look at that because Dave was demanding my attention. Isn't that wild? Even from, you know, what was he, 15 maybe? He grabbed your attention, you know, with the saxophone and singing all these American rock songs and everything at the time. Mm-hmm. And I went to the school a year later. My father was his art teacher. Hold on, we got a big motorcycle just going by.
That's okay.
Okay. So the first lunch time I was at the school, I made a beeline for Dave, and we became fast friends, and George Underwood, who was Dave's best friend for life, and who's still a dear friend of mine, and a wonderful painter, and did the Ziggy Stardust cover and lots of other stuff for David. And they were both taught by my father. So we would... We were able to bring our guitars to school, and I don't think we called it jamming then, but we would play together in lunchtime and stuff like that. But then Dave went off and did his career. Davy Jones and the Nighttimers, Davy Jones and this, and then all of a sudden he was David Bowie, and because of the Monkees. So he wanted to change his name.
Yeah.
So I didn't blame him. So then, you know, we're friends and always, you know, now and then touching base, not seeing each other all the time, but catching up every now and again. And then Dave invited me to play on one of his records and play on the Glass Spider tour. And I couldn't believe it that we are finally going to play on the same stage. We'd played on the same stage, but not in the same band, the same night, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But we'd never actually played together on stage. And since that first jam and on the steps. Mm. And that was the wonderful thing that he did for me. He knew where my credibility was as a guitarist because of the Teeny Bopper stuff. That had derived from the aftermath of Comes Alive and the release of I'm in You and Sgt. Pepper and all that.
Right.
And he had given me this wonderful gift, which was he reintroduced me as the musician, the guitar player around the world in stadiums. And for that, I never stopped thanking him, and I still do to this day.
That's great. He brought you back to your roots. It is so great to have you on, and the book is really an amazing read, and I'm so happy for all of your success. You've lived a great life, and you're going to live a much longer life, I'm sure, but the book is Do You Feel Like I Do? It's great to have you on. Congratulations on all the success in the book, and a real joy to have you on the show, Peter Frampton.
Well, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
All right, there you go. That's Peter Frampton. So psyched to have him on. Check out youtube.com/PaulMercurio. I got some fun videos up there, and we'll see you next week, everybody.